For Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. Public hangings. This is a hot dog. It's Antiwar Radio on Chaos Radio, 92.7 and 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Streaming live online, KAOS959.com. Check out Antiwar.com, your one-stop shopping for all the bad news in the world and good opinion columns all about it. Interesting ones. My blog is thestressblog.com. Stop by and say rude things in the comment section. Having lots of fun over at the Stress Blog. And let's see, other websites I should tell you about. Well, I'll be telling you about an article on LouRockwell.com here in a minute. Hey, look at LibertyStickers.com and buy some anti-government propaganda for the back of your car, particularly from the Scott Horton section. That way I get a dollar. Straight to what's important here. Second hour today, Max Blumenthal. You might have seen Matt Bargainier blogged it on antiwar.com. What do you call it? Knucking futs or crazy like a fox? Hey, you can't cuss on antiwar.com's front page, but anyway, you know what he's getting at. And, you know, I actually emailed Matt and I said, well, the answer is, you know, knucking futs like a fox. It's both, of course, not either or. If you didn't see it, you don't know what the hell I'm talking about. I'm talking about Christians United for Israel, John Hagee, the pastor from San Antonio, and, his group of, left behind kooks. In this merger with the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, the center of the Israel lobby here in America, and their push for war against Iran. And, you know, I sit up here debunking the case for war against Iran every day. Nuclear bombs and, you know, tied with Al-Qaeda and supplying the landmines that are killing our guys in Iraq. All a bunch of lies. And I sit up here, you know, 5 days a week basically debunking these lies, and yet there's an entire segment of the population who none of that would matter even if I could convince them. What matters to them, apparently, is a situation they wish to force in which Russia and Iran team up and invade Israel, and then Jesus will come and defeat Satan, kill all the Jews who refuse to convert to Christianity, and take all the true believers up to heaven. And then Satan will rule us all under the United Nations for 1,000 years or some shit like that. And that's why we have to have a war against Iran. It ain't that they're guilty of anything. You see, it's just that Jesus won't get his act together and get down here and kill everybody fast enough. And so they need to force his hand. And Max Blumenthal from The Nation magazine, he went and observed this Christians United for Israel concert, convention, put the video up there on the Huffington Post blog, and you can find, of course, at thestressblog.com or at antiwar.com/blog, where Matt Bargainier posted it. And boy, oh boy, man, that's something to behold, these people. I'll tell you, you can pretty much go anywhere in America and find a large group of kooks standing around, but with this much political power, it's really something to behold there. The absolutely ridiculous shall inherit the earth. So that's in the second hour, Max Blumenthal from The Nation. But I wanted to start off the show today really by pointing you to this article by John V. Denson at lewrockwell.com. It's the top article today. And boy, there's no mistaking why that is. It's called FDR, Pearl Harbor, and the UN. And it's a review of a book by George Victor called The Pearl Harbor Myth, Rethinking the Unthinkable. And I already have a request into Potomac Books for my review copy. Hope to get it in the mail here real soon. I never get tired of reading about how Franklin Delano Roosevelt is the greatest traitor in the history of all mankind. He makes Benedict Arnold look like George fucking Washington. He set up 3,500 American boys, 18, 19 years old, to be blown apart by high explosives and drowned in the Pacific Ocean so that he could get America into a war in Europe. And that is a fact, Jack. Robert B. Stinnett proved it beyond any shadow of a doubt in his book, Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor, that came out in 1999. And now here's another one, The Pearl Harbor Myth, Rethinking the Unthinkable by George Victor. And again, going back to Robert B. Stinnett's scholarship here and the documents he found. And you know, it's funny, I guess I'll go ahead and tell this anecdote. I don't think I'm sworn to secrecy or anything. Anthony Gregory, my good friend from the Independent Institute, he was there. And where Robert B. Stinnett is a fellow as well. And Robert B. Stinnett showed him where he was going through his Freedom of Information Act requests, all his information about decoded radio traffic and so forth, and all his investigation about the Pearl Harbor event. And here in all these files was just this one loose piece of paper stuck, you know, left away from everything else. Just, you know, right in between two manila folders or something like that. And Robert B. Stinnett apparently kind of reenacted how he found it to Anthony Gregory. Yeah, here it was, and he pulls it out. And it was a memo by a member of the United States Navy Intelligence Corps named Arthur McCollum. And he had spent, I think, 20 years or something earlier in his life in Japan. Was extremely familiar with their customs and ways, culture, society, and everything else. And he wrote up this plan, the 8-point plan, how to provoke Japan into attacking us first. And the different points were, for example, leaving the fleet out at Hawaii instead of bringing them back to San Diego. Of course, Hawaii was just a territory America had stolen only, 50 years before that. They did all these things, too. They surfaced submarines off the coast of Japan, within view in a provocative way. They made deals with the Dutch and the British to put on a full-scale military embargo and ban any trading of steel or oil with the Japanese. I forget the whole thing. It's been a while. But you go through, it was A through H, I guess. And then they went and added a couple of more. Just to make sure, and it even says on the paperwork, by all means, the Japanese must be maneuvered into firing the first shot. And that's a proven fact now. It's not a conspiracy theory. It took a long time. Now, John T. Flynn, I guess he was a conspiracy theorist when he wrote about Pearl Harbor back in the 1940s. But it's all a proven fact now. You can read Day of Deceit, and apparently now you can read the Pearl Harbor myth, all about it. And there's an important lesson here, and it's one that we can extrapolate on, and that is that presidents are just people, and in fact, 99 times out of 100, they are the very worst among us. That's how they get that much power. And Darth Roosevelt is no exception to that. I saw a great picture of him last night on, I think it was The Daily Show or something. They showed this old picture of him wearing a black cloak. Looked like Darth Vader, only with a top hat instead of a Nazi helmet, but same difference. Four-term president of the United States told the American people in his first election campaign, we're tired of this New Deal, big government, progressive conservatism from the likes of the Republican Herbert Hoover. I promise to return us to a free market economy and let this depression work itself out and have a limited republic and a rule of law like it's supposed to be. And then he became the president and it did exactly what Hoover had begun and only to the nth degree. And created the New Deal. And then the New Deal destroyed the American economy even more than the Federal Reserve already had. And of course, you know, the Dust Bowl and all that. Then he had to figure out how to get us into a war or else he was sunk. And so he went for it. Also had to try to figure out a way to save the Soviet Union. Of course, we all know now, right, that Harry Hopkins and Harry Dexter White and Alger Hiss, all of Roosevelt's top three best friends, closest right-hand men, were all KGB agents. And when Hitler turned on Stalin, something had to be done. America had to get into that war, not to save England, but to save the Soviet Union. And so they maneuvered, they figured out a way to maneuver America into a war with Japan as an excuse to turn around and go to war in Europe. Guess Hitler's big mistake was living up to his treaty with the Japanese and declaring war on America once we got into the war with Japan. But, and no, I'm not saying, you know, screw the Jews in the Holocaust. And no, I'm not saying it would be perfectly fine for the Nazis to rule the world. Fact of the matter is, Roosevelt did as little about the Holocaust as possible for as long as possible. The railways to the death camps were on the, even if you're on your way back and you missed your first target and you have bombs left over, do not bomb these railways list. You know, right there with the General Motors and Ford plants on the do not bomb list. They did as little about as possible. And frankly, if Roosevelt had said, come on, everybody, let's go to Europe to save the Jews, they would have hung him on the front lawn of the White House. That's not what the war was about. It was a great side effect, and it's nice to say, yeah, we fought World War II to save the Jews, but that was the very last thing on the list. The American people weren't even told about what was going on in Germany and Poland in terms of the Holocaust. It was kept secret until after the war. So anyway, I also think that the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany basically would have killed each other off if America had not opened up the Western Front against Germany. I think Germany probably would have been able to defeat the Soviets and then would have fallen apart themselves. England was already safe. The Battle of Britain was over. America didn't need to enter that war. The American people by 88%, which you can't get 88% to agree today's Friday, okay? But 88% of the American people said, hell no. And Roosevelt said, oh, I swear to God, I will not send your boys to fight in any foreign wars. And that was a lie. It's not that, oh, gee, circumstances took place and he had to go back on his promise that he really meant to keep. No, he was a liar. And anyway, it's like the bumper sticker says, he was the worst president in American history probably until now. But let's rewind. Let's go back. Let's just count the wars. The War of 1812 through 14, I don't know that there was a specific event, you know, that was blown out of proportion. But frankly, it was Thomas Jefferson and James Madison's economic war against Britain that got us into that war. In the North, they called it Mr. Madison's War, which ought to be a clue as to the war of choice nature of what was going on. Yes, it's true the British were conscripting Americans on the high seas and all that, but really I think that war was the result of Jefferson practicing the exact opposite of what he preached, and that was his the economic war that he was waging in his administration against Britain, and Madison's continuation of that policy. An unnecessary war, and one that made Andrew Jackson an American hero. Thanks a lot, James Madison. You know, I like your Bill of Rights, all right, but the rest of this is, you know. Anyway, so moving on from there, war against Mexico, James K. Polk, the day Texas joined the Union or something that week, they sent the U.S. Army to the Rio Grande. when the border of Texas was the San Jacinto. And in fact, Lincoln was called Spotty Lincoln because he gave speeches in the House of Representatives that said, now wait a minute, President Polk tells us that the Mexicans invaded American soil and shed American blood on American soil. But what soil exactly is he talking about now? Because the border of Texas is the San Jacinto, not the Rio Grande. And everybody knows that. It wasn't in dispute, as they try to say now. Polk invaded Mexico. They defended themselves. That's how America came to steal the entire western half of the United States, basically, from at least the southwest, from Mexico, including California and Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, etc. That was all, or parts of Utah at least, anyway, Nevada. That was Mexico. And they stole it in an aggressive war, and they lied to the American people and said that the Mexicans were the aggressors when that wasn't true, and they knew that wasn't true. The next major war after that, of course, there's little imperialist missions for, you know, in Latin America and so forth, all throughout this, too innumerable to name. But the next major war after that was the War of Northern Aggression, otherwise known as the Civil War, which in fact it was not. A civil war is when two sides or more are fighting over who's going to control the central government and dominate the rest. Well, the South was not trying to conquer the North. The South was trying to declare its independence and secede from the Union. And Abraham Lincoln would not let them go. That's not a civil war. That's a war of Northern aggression. And in fact, the way they did it was when the states all started seceding from the Union, and as Mr. Denson points out in his article today, Lincoln proposed a constitutional amendment to protect slavery forever in order to try to keep the Deep South states in the Union. Well, they kept seceding anyway. There was only, it was just the Carolinas. I don't even know if North Carolina. It was South Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, I think, were all at first. And so all the federal property in these states started reverting back to the control of the southern states. Well, Lincoln came up with a plan to keep the federal troops at Fort Sumter and to reinforce them and resupply them, and hoped that within a matter of time, the South would finally fire on Fort Sumter and try to force those federal troops out of that bay that, frankly, they had no jurisdiction to be there anymore. It reminds me of what was Fort Sumter. It was a tax collection post. That's what it was. The great quote of Abraham Lincoln from When in the Course of Human Events by Charles Adams. He says, but if the South secedes, who will pay my tariff? Yeah. So anyway, it was April 19th, 1861, on the anniversary of Lexington and Concord, that the South finally fell into the trap and fired on Fort Sumter. And at that point, the war was on, and within five years, the South was conquered, and the Republic was dead and the American Empire born. Immediately went to conquer the last of the Indians, kill them all off, because, of course, they started it, those Indians. And, sorry, I guess I don't really need to elaborate that point, do I? And then the next major war after the Indian Wars is the war against Spain. Well, Western expansion is done. The continent's conquered, except for Mexico and Canada. We'll get to them with their North American Union in another 100 years. But, you know, we conquered all the way to the Pacific. Now what? Well, now we need a foreign empire, too. And so there was an accident on the battleship Maine, which for some reason was in port in Cuba, which was owned by Spain and was in the middle of its fight for independence from Spain. And it was an accident. It was a fire in the coal room. It spread to the magazine. The ship blew up and sank. Well, they called it Remember the Maine. The Spanish saboteurs bombed our wonderful battleship. We must take revenge. And so America got into a war with Spain. In fact, I just saw a thing on the History Channel about the Spanish fleet was made of wood. The Americans, you know, it was like three or four ships and on this suicide mission, basically, for the honor of Spain, as the American Navy quickly routed them. And William Graham Sumner, back then, 110 years ago now, wrote, I hope I can remember the exact title of it, something to the effect of How Spain Conquered America in the Recent War. That's not how it is. I forget the title. America's Conquest by Spain. And it's about how we beat them in the war, but we adopted their system. Now we are an imperial European power just like Spain. We are no longer different. We're no longer the New World, different from the mother continent that our ancestors had fled from, etc., etc. Now we are Spain. We have replaced them as a world empire. And then here we go, stole Cuba and Puerto Rico and the Philippines. And boy, the Filipinos were like, yay, the Spanish Empire is defeated. We're free. Hey, what's that on the horizon? Red, white, and blue? Crap. And so a major counterinsurgency was fought there in the Philippines, and hundreds of thousands of Filipinos were killed. The instructions, the rules of engagement were any male over the age of 10 is fair game. And, you know, in high school, my history teacher showed me pictures of American soldiers standing on top of the piles of skulls of the people of the Philippines. And, you know, McKinley said that that war was to Christianize them, even though a supermajority of them were already Catholics. They'd been conquered by Spain for 200 years or something. They were already Christians. Oh, maybe we had to beat that papism out of them and make them Presbyterians. Is that it, Mr. McKinley? Something like that? You're starting to catch on to the common theme here is that every time these wars start, what they told us about how and why they started isn't true. World War I is a great example. The Lusitania was filled with civilians and British munitions, bought on loan by J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan fronting a bunch of munitions to the British. Promised to pay me back, right? Oy, better not lose. So they put a bunch of Americans on a British ship of war, and they sailed it into waters where they knew there were German U-boats. They called off the British destroyer, the Juno, which was the Lusitania's escort, ordered them to reduce their speed. It was a very fast ship, could have outrun a submarine, no problem. But they ordered them to turn off one of their engines. Coincidentally, it was the Lord Admiralty of the Navy, Winston Churchill, and the future great dictator, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was the Secretary of the Navy at the time. And they got a bunch of American civilians killed on a British ship of war that they had no idea was packed with munitions. Well, that still wasn't quite good enough to get us into the war. And so they trotted out the Zimmerman telegram, where the Germans supposedly were promising the Mexicans that if you invade the United States and help us conquer them, we will help you with the war and take back the Southwest. I know that at least somebody in the audience right now is thinking, wow, that sounds like a pretty serious threat. Well, except that the German Navy was blockaded in port by the British. They couldn't go anywhere. They were being strangled to death. They weren't a threat to anyone. They were going to help Mexico invade America and take back the Southwest? That's a threat? To life and liberty in this country? Give me a break. You know? Yeah, I heard Angola just promised, Mozambique that they're going to invade and conquer us too. You know, I guess we get to bomb them. I just made that up. Please don't take that as a casus belli. I was just kidding. So then finally there was the evil German attack on the Sussex and the killing of American civilians there. And that was it. Woodrow Wilson had had enough. It was time to go and make the world safe for democracy, as his handler slash aide, Colonel Edward Mandell House, had negotiated with the British and the French a year earlier would take place. And it turned out that the Sussex hadn't even been sunk. It's all in this article today on LouRockwell.com by John V. Denson. No, they just hit it. It was fired on, but it didn't sink. And they just hit it long enough for the American people to believe that American civilians had been killed on board. And that's how they got us into World War I. And this is where our story changes pardon me, changes a little bit from the government lies us into every single war that we fought in our entire history since 1814, at least, if you don't want to include that one, to it also sets us up for the next one. You know, it's, I guess you could argue that the war against Spain led us, you know, toward war with Japan. I mean, after all, how'd we get control of the Philippines and so forth? You know, so I guess, you know, you can always trace these interventions back. I guess you'd really have to start at the war against Spain, but World War One was the big deal, and there's a great book called Wilson's War by Jim Powell, a Cato Institute guy, and actually I wrote an article about this too called Blame Wilson. Because of America's intervention in World War One, that was absolutely none of our business, and in direct contravention of the mandate of the founders of this country. Because of that, the stalemate in Europe was destroyed. The fact that all the European powers at war were all basically going to lose at the same time and just call it quits, and no one was going to have a victory, which probably would have been really good. You know, maybe it would have just been a pause in the war till a little later or something, but certainly the people of Europe had had it. The people of Germany, the government of Germany was suing for peace. The British and the French were only holding on because of the promise of Edward Mandel House and Woodrow Wilson that America was on its way. And America came in and turned the proportion of force on to the side of the French and the British so much, and the Russians, so much that Germany was forced to surrender unconditionally and forced to accept the Treaty of Versailles, which basically made them responsible for paying the entire cost of the war on all sides, which of course was impossible. It absolutely destroyed their economy. We've all seen pictures of the German woman with the wheelbarrow full of currency trying to go buy a single loaf of bread from the hyperinflation. Again, what happens when government counterfeits money? It makes the money you already have worth less, right? And that's exactly what happened, only on a hyper level, they call it. And the German economy was absolutely destroyed. One nice touch that Wilson added was the tyrants, the German imperialists who had fought the war in World War One, Wilson was too good to accept surrender from them. No, he would only accept surrender from the German Democrats who had opposed the war all along. Well, guess what? Adolf Hitler began every speech he gave for the first, you know, dozen years of his drive to power with the traitors of 1918 who sold us out to the British and the French and the Americans. The traitors of 1918. That's right. Who were the bad guys in Germany? Not the people who fought the war, not the imperialists who said, yeah, we can take on Russia and Britain and France and everybody, it'll be great. Not them. The Democrats that Wilson forced to accept the surrender, the people who had opposed the war, were the ones who got the blame in Adolf Hitler's speeches during his rise to power that could only be made possible by the complete and total destruction of the German economy by the Treaty of Versailles that would have never existed had Woodrow Wilson kept America out of that war like he swore to God to do. Also, Woodrow Wilson, on his way into entering World War One, sent his emissaries with piles of gold to convince Kerensky, who was the interim leader, who was to be just the interim leader of Russia after the Tsar was overthrown in March of 1917. They bribed the hell out of him, Wilson did, to stay in the war. We gotta keep you in the war on the Eastern Front. Here's some guns. Here's a ton of money. Stay in the war. Kerensky went for it, and the people of Russia, as we all know, were sick and tired of fighting this war against the Germans. They wanted an end to the war, and Lenin and Trotsky, on their fourth try, were able to topple the Kerensky government in October of 1917 and create the Soviet Union. again, all Woodrow Wilson's fault. And what else happened in World War I? The Ottoman Empire was destroyed forever. And who inherited the Middle East? The British and the French. The French got Syria and Lebanon. The British got the rest. Remember Lawrence of Arabia? Yeah, you Arabs, help us fight the Turks and we'll give you your independence. With this sword, not just a knife, but the sword in the back. You know, it's funny, I read something that Osama bin Laden, a speech that Osama bin Laden gave, where he talked about the humiliation of 80 years ago, and this was, I guess, in the mid-90s. And he's talking, of course, about America helping the British steal the Middle East from the Turks and from the people of the Middle East. And, of course, also to I keep wanting to say the Zimmerman telegram, but that ain't it. I already covered that. It's the Balfour Declaration, Lord Balfour, who wrote a letter to Lord Rothschild saying, yes, it will now be the policy of the British government to go along with the Zionist project and transplant Jews to Palestine. And that was the beginning of that. And then, so of course, you know, we all know, as Jacob Hornberger said on the show the other day, it really isn't World War I and World War II. It's just one big war with a period in between there. But everybody knows that World War II was largely the result, not just of World War I, but of American intervention in World War I, which created the Soviet Union and led to the creation of the Nazi Reich in Germany. And of course, as I discussed at the top of the hour, Roosevelt had to lie the American people into this war, had to set up their sons to be blown apart by high explosives and drown in the sea at Pearl Harbor so that he could get his war in Europe. It's the worst treason in the history of the United States of America. But 88% of the American people wanted nothing to do with that war. And so he had to kill their children in order to convince them that it was, well, he had to set their children up to be killed by the Japanese, let me be clear, so that they could get into the war in Europe. And the result of the war, America's participation in World War II, of course, is that we inherited the British Empire, the French Empire, the German Empire, and the Japanese Empire. The only thing we didn't get was the Soviet Union. Two-thirds of the world for us, one-third for them. And America's been in a state of war ever since. People say, well, you know, they haven't declared war since 1941. Well, maybe that's because that war never really ended. You know? I mean, I'm not saying legally, technically. I'm just saying it sure does seem like, you know, what happened there basically was, and, you know, it's funny. In Asia, they even took the name. What was called the Japanese Greater Kobe Prosperity Sphere became the American Asian Kobe Prosperity Sphere. They even kept the name of the Japanese Empire in Asia. You know, and in fact, I saw a clip. Oh, I know what it was. It was from the trailer from Norman Solomon's new movie, War Made Easy. That's based on his book. And he plays the clip of Ike Eisenhower saying, now listen, if Vietnam falls to the Reds, then that threatens our supplies of tin and tungsten and whatever. It's Rockefeller concerns want those minerals, and we're not going to let the Reds have them. That was the origin of the American war in formerly French Indochina. Screw those people. If you know, 3 or 4 million of them have to die. There's tungsten in the ground there, and we want it. You know, as though there's not tungsten anywhere else in the world. Give me a break. But there you go. Vietnam War. Well, don't let me skip ahead. In Korea, they didn't bother, you know, pretending that Korea had attacked us or anything. Harry Truman inherited all the gall of the traitor Franklin Roosevelt. And then added on, you know, the tough guy appeal of having dropped nuclear bombs on helpless civilians. Of course, you all know that the only military target in Nagasaki was a prison where American prisoners of war were being held. there were no other military targets there except American prisoners of war in Nagasaki. You know that, right? Okay, well, Truman had inherited all that chutzpah. And he said, oh, U.S. Senate, you ratified the United Nations treaty. Which, in fact, wasn't really so much a treaty as it was sort of a constitution for a global federation, and the Senate doesn't have the authority anywhere in the Constitution to ratify such a thing. But anyway, Truman said, hey, you ratified the United Nations treaty. I don't need a declaration of war. And he sent the army to Korea in the middle of the night under the United Nations. You might remember there were calls for Al Gore to be hung for treason just back in, you know, 1997 or something, when a few bodies of Americans from Korea were brought home with their coffins draped in United Nations flags. Remember that? That was the first United Nations war. Make it or break it for the world body. Does the Security Council have the authority to initiate aggressive war, or doesn't it? Ah, yes, it does. That was the Korean War. They lied to the American people, said the Soviet Union was a threat, which was ridiculous. Particularly at that time, they hadn't even tested their first atom bomb yet. They just lost 20 million people. My good friend corrected me. Not 20 million men, 20 million people in the great patriotic war against Germany. They were no threat to anyone except, you know, the people of Eastern Europe, basically. But that was the end of the authority of Congress to declare war, and it, based on deceit. Nobody ever told the U.S. Senate that they were giving up their power to declare war to the United Nations Security Council. I'm sure they didn't before the UN Charter was ratified. But then, of course, the next major escalation there, I won't say the beginning of the next war, because, of course, the war had been being fought on low levels through the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations. But Lyndon Johnson seized on the pretext of the Gulf of Tonkin, where Idiot, the new sonar boy who just got out of training, spent all day saying, "Oh my God, Captain! Turn hard right. There's a torpedo headed right for us," when it turned out it was the sound of his own propeller. And at some point at 4 p.m, the admiral or the captain or whatever the ship said, "Now, how could it be that I successfully dodged, you know, 36 torpedoes today without getting hit a single time? Somebody wake up the experienced sonar man and get him in here to take a listen to these headphones." Oh, okay, there was no second attack. There was a first attack at the Gulf of Tonkin, but that was a legitimate response to American special forces types and South Vietnamese doing raids in North Vietnamese territory. That was legit, and that was the day before. The second Gulf of Tonkin attack, which, you know, wasn't even called the Gulf of Tonkin then, really, because, at least at first, because they were pretending they were out in international waters, which they weren't. The Gulf of Tonkin was the Gulf of Tonkin. It was North Vietnamese waters. Look at a map. Anyway, they used this phony attack. Chapter 1 of Secrets by Daniel Ellsberg tells the story of how it was his first day on the job as the Assistant Deputy Secretary of Defense for lying and killing people or whatever it was. And he was sitting there all day receiving the information from the Pacific Ocean and relaying it to D.C. He was at the Pentagon. It was his first day on the job. And he said, you know, by that afternoon, it was clear that the whole thing was an accident, that a mistaken impression that there was no second attack. And it didn't matter, because Lyndon Johnson decided to pretend that he didn't know that the second one never happened. And he went out and he told the American people that those dastardly North Vietnamese have initiated a war of aggression against the United States, and that we had the right to defend ourselves. And they passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which was not a declaration of war or an authorization to use force. It was simply a blank check. Mr. President, spend as much money as you want killing whoever you want, and make sure and buy lots of helicopters from Bell. Go right ahead. And so that's how they lied people into the Vietnam War. And, you know, it's funny. I don't remember who anymore. But I remember when I was a kid that there were a couple of kids in the neighborhood. It must have been from a few streets over. I remember as a young kid, there were a couple of kids that I think were 2 or 3 years older than me who had never known their fathers because their fathers had died in Vietnam for Rockefeller's tungsten, for Lyndon Johnson's Gulf of Tonkin. these kids that I knew didn't even know their fathers. Anyway, the entire Cold War, I guess I mentioned briefly, was a lie. The Soviet Union was no threat to us. And you look at how we defeated the Soviet Union. We defeated the Soviet Union by ceasing to contain them. The policy of containment was ended with our defeat. Ooh, I hope that hurts your feelings, little right-winger out there. Don't cry. Our defeat in Vietnam led the American people to say, you know what, fuck it. If the Soviets want to, you know, take on problems in Angola and, San Salvador and whatever, Afghanistan, let them. We don't want to contain communism anymore. We just got defeated in Vietnam. And so we don't really want any of this. Well, Zbigniew Brzezinski said, you know what, huh? What if we kind of run with this? And what if instead of containing them, since the American people don't have the will to continue this policy of containment anymore, what if we bait them and trick them into fighting in Afghanistan and give them their own Vietnam? And so that's what they did. America supported it, and you know, they say, well, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, America went to help. No, it was, and Brzezinski is on the record admitting this. You can use your Google machine and check it out. You know, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's foreign policy, national security advisor. They came up with a plan to support rebels against the puppet communist dictatorship in Afghanistan, which drove the Russians miscalculated and decided what they ought to do is invade to prop up the local communist government. And then America and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan sent bazillions of dollars to the Mujahideen, that is Afghanistani fighters as well as Arabs who were sent there from, of course, you all know that, you know, people in Afghanistan are not Arabs. Arabs are all from quite a few hundred miles west of there. Anyway, so they sent all these Arabs through Pakistan with CIA money, training, Chinese AK-47s and so forth, Stinger missiles, shoulder-fired Stinger missiles. And they waged a holy jihad against the Soviet Union. And basically, that's how the Soviet Union was destroyed. They were finally allowed to overextend themselves when America revoked the policy of containment. All empires fall. Contain one. I think the lesson is you just keep it alive longer. Soviet Union fell not long after they withdrew in humiliated defeat from Afghanistan, much like we had done in Vietnam. It could be said that they're, doing their part to pay us back now, or at least they're laughing as we give ourselves our own another Vietnam. And of course, they lied us into the war in Iraq, folks. July 25th. Wow, I should have mentioned this on the anniversary or something a couple of days ago. July 25th, 1990, Saddam Hussein says to the American ambassador, April Glaspie, hey, the Kuwaitis are overproducing from our joint oil pools. They've got the price down to, what, 10, 12 bucks. I can't pay back my debts to them, to the Saudis, to anybody for the war that you guys had me fight against Iran to protect Saudi Arabia, to protect Kuwait. And the Emir of Kuwait is sticking it to me, man. What should I do? What would America do if I tried to resolve this? You know, Hussein's way. And April Glaspie says, well, Secretary of State James Baker has emphasized to me the instruction of our policy since 1960. The Kuwait issue is not associated with America. We are not interested in your inter-Arab affairs. Which, is, of course, is laughable. But there you go. James Baker has emphasized to me that I should emphasize to you that if you want to go over there and kneecap the Kuwaitis for overproducing from your shared oil pools, then be James Baker's guest, Mr. Hussein. Then the invasion started 5 days later. And Hussein, instead of taking the northern oil fields and teaching the Kuwaiti royalty a lesson, went all the way to the Persian Gulf. Said, hey, I'm Saddam Hussein. The Americans got my back. Nobody can stop me now. And he went all the way to the Persian Gulf. Well, George Bush said, what do I care? This James Baker tells me this is the way you do it in Texas. If four property owners are all pumping from one shared pool of oil under the ground, under all their property, hey, somebody starts overproducing beyond their quota and ripping off their neighbors from the deal they got, that's how you get your kneecaps broke. That's the way it works. And that's what James Baker gave Saddam Hussein permission to do to the Kuwaitis. Well, then, live on TV, Margaret Thatcher says, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, which, remember, America declared independence from and all that long before? Yeah. Well, she says to George Bush on television, don't you go wobbly on me, George. Aw, damn, you just got called a wimp by a woman on TV. What are you going to do? Well, immediately he raises his finger in the air and he says, this will not stand. This aggression will not stand. America will undo what Iraq has done. And then, of course, they would not take I surrender for an answer in the entire Operation Desert Shield and all that crap and the build-up to the war. Saddam Hussein tried 15 different ways to give up an offer to retreat from Kuwait, and America wouldn't let him. And they deliberately rigged all the peace offers. They said, yeah, you have to have everyone out in 2 days. Oh. Okay, well, since that's impossible, I guess I can't do that, so you're going to have a war, basically. Put Hussein in a situation and couldn't do anything about it. And, you know, I guess I would be remiss if I didn't, you know, address this to some degree. There are a lot of people who say that the September 11th attack itself was an inside job. I haven't seen the evidence for that. I think, if anything, what we're looking at is a Pearl Harbor type situation where they knew an attack was coming, whether they had deliberately provoked it or not. And, you know, I have to give it a 51% or maybe even a 60% probability that high people in the administration deliberately turned a blind eye. On the other hand, I think that there's so much evidence to indicate that the information was not even getting to the top. Now, you know, you don't have to believe that. I ain't really trying to convince you, but it sure does look to me in a lot of ways like Michael Scheuer's right, and what he told me was there's so much childish gossiping and backstabbing and infighting at the, you know, worker level, at the CIA and the FBI, and particularly the bottom layer of supervisors, that Scheuer said he'd have been amazed if Cheney knew anything to turn a blind eye to. And I really think that that is extremely plausible. And whether anybody in our government knew the attack was coming and deliberately, you know, turned a blind eye or not, they took advantage of it in the very first, you know, as their very first order of business. From that day, we have it in their notes. Stephen Cambone taking notes for his boss, Don Rumsfeld. Hit SH2. No good targets in Afghanistan. Sweep it all up. Things related and not. We want to hit Iraq, let's hit Iraq. Let's go after him immediately. Richard Clark says on September 12th, the president is telling him, find me where Iraq did this. And Richard Clark says, no, sir, it was Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan did this. And Bush says, yeah, anyway, find me where this is Iraq's fault, would you? Thanks. That was the agenda immediately, was to blame it on Iraq. And in fact, I think that speaks against the inside job thesis. If Cheney was behind this thing, why didn't they put at least a couple Iraqis on board? I mean, the best they could do was this, you know, mythical meeting between Iraqi intelligence and Mohammed Atta in Prague, Czechoslovakia, which just didn't happen and which was, you know, roundly debunked and disproven. But anyway, they lied their asses off and they lied to the American people, not outright. Well, Cheney did. But the rest of the administration did not lie outright to the American people in the sense of saying Iraq did it. Now, they did lie and say that Iraq had all kinds of ties to Al-Qaeda and weapons of mass destruction, which for some reason was a reason to invade them. I can't imagine. But anyway, but they didn't outright lie, for the most part, except for Cheney, didn't outright lie and say that Iraq did 9/11. What they said was this. Someone would ask the question and say, Mr. Bush, why do we have to go to war against Iraq? And Bush would say, because of 9/11. Because we learned the lesson that you can't just wait around for somebody to attack you. You have to attack them first. But see, the first part of his answer sounds like he's saying that they did it. And for the American people who refuse to think critically about what the world's sickest liars and murderers tell them, good enough. And of course, many, many people still to this day think that Iraq did 9/11, or else why would we have invaded them? It must be that Saddam Hussein was in on that attack. 41% of the American people now, 41% higher. It's up again. It's up a good 6 points since March or May. Forget. There you go. So now they're trying to lie us into a war against Iran. And they have a myriad, gigantic list of excuses for going to war with Iran, none of which are a good enough reason by themselves, and none of them good enough even when they're all lumped together in one big group of excuses. Especially since it's all lies. They accuse Iran of developing nuclear weapons when there's no evidence whatsoever that they're developing nuclear weapons. All their nuclear facilities are safeguarded by the International Atomic Energy Agency. They are enriching uranium when they can get their act together at all to 3.5%, not to 90-something percent that you would need to make a fission bomb. And they would have to withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, kick the IAEA out of the country, and then begin trying to make a bomb, and it would take them about a good decade from that point. They do not have, there is no evidence at all that there is a nuclear weapons program of any description in Iran, period. They also lie and say that Iran is behind the killing of our guys in Iraq and Afghanistan, which is just lies. The Iranian government is not supplying weapons to America's enemies in Iraq or Afghanistan. There's no evidence of it whatsoever. And every time Cheney puts out some leak from the office of the vice president saying so, the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, or one of his generals says, no, that's not really right. I mean, it could be. Some of these weapons are coming across the Iranian border, but, hey, it's a big country. It's not like America can secure any of Iraq's borders, so why should the Iranians be able to? Can't secure our own borders, not like I'm asking for it, but I'm just saying they try and they fail. There is no evidence. And in fact, there is plenty of evidence, despite what you may have heard, that the EFP, new and improved explosively formed penetrator landmines that are being used against our guys in Iraq, are made in Iraq. On April, was it the 9th or the 11th? Hang on, I got it in my notes here, man. I'll find it for you here. Gareth Porter, peace offer. Scott Blackwell, Christian Science Monitor, April 10th, 2007, Operation Black Eagle in the Diwania province. They found an explosively formed penetrator factory just 100 miles or less south of Baghdad. So keep that in mind. They also say that solder, who is nominally America's enemy among the Shia in Iraq, works for Iran, when in fact he's the nationalist. It's the people we're supporting, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawah Party, who are tied with Iran. There's another big lie for you. They say that Ahmadinejad, who is not the supreme leader by any description, it's the Ayatollah Khamenei who is in Iran. This guy is simply like Juan Cole compared him to the Secretary of the Interior here in America. Not the Secretary of Interior in Iraq, which means the head of the death squad. The Secretary of the Interior in America means he's in charge of, national parks and, the Hoover Dam or something? I don't know. That supposedly he threatened to wipe Israel off the map. Well, he didn't. He said, well, just like the Soviet Union disappeared, even though it seemed like it would last forever, so too one day the regime, the government in Jerusalem will vanish from the page of time. That's what he said. He didn't say that he or Iran was going to wipe anyone off anything. It's just damn lies, and the people who tell you that lie know that they're lying. And that's the good part. And that's it. So anyway, we're about to come back. I'm going to play a song, and then I got a couple of more news stories. But then we're going to talk with Max Blumenthal about some of these people who want war with Iran and why. This is the Christians United for Israel. Is that because they love Jews? Nope. It's because they want Jesus to come back and murder all the Jews. And, I guess most of them, to their credit, hope that they get to fly away on their magic golden parachute before Jesus kills all the Jews, you know, rather than sitting around, you know, wanting to watch it. But anyway, that's the Christians United for Israel. We'll be back here in a few to talk with Max Blumenthal all about that. This here's the Goody Mob from Atlanta. Oh man, I forgot Panama and Grenada. They completely fucking lied us into both of those wars too. I know I take for granted at times, but what I got, still hustling, bustling now and then. I slang a rock or two to come up, a steady battle through the days. Mama think I'm wrong because I want to get paid. The system ain't giving Timo a chance when it's two on the loose and black. Trying to get this loose a little slack around my neck. They're making it hard for a brother to cope. It's still illegal to smoke, said because they can't tax. I'm ready to roll up in the White House with my axe and chop up shit until they give me my shit back.
So what, who's damn? You got caught, saw a way out the trail. It's getting full, calling up your pool, but pool ain't got it. I feel cold inside like a man sleeping on pavement under a bridge of I-20 west and stress on the face of the man cussing out the atmosphere when nobody close enough to hear. And who they miss they feet, cause all their personal shit is sitting on the front lawn of apple tree. And for those who ain't got tape, before the owner show back up with the U-Haul, police you call, but wasn't no marshal there to walk. See, I stand tall to this world like a kid walking, rapping his rhyme to himself. A book on the shelf, a mini of seeds, seen them come and go. Style free with Cabreeze, still it's thick like that fog. Sacking away the extra for an engine for the hog. Dropping a point from the east, from a location from the trees. 360 degrees.
Born into these crooked ways, I never even asked to come. So now I'm living in the days. I struggle and fight to stay alive, hoping that one day I earn a chance to die. Paul bearer to this one, Paul bearer to that one. Can't seem to get the grip, cause my palms wet.
Niggas ain't getting nowhere fast, but closer to the hearse. While some beams burst on baskets, really blinded me. Almost dropped my head of the casket, wood grains. And the only thing on my brain is where this coward hang. Swat, swat, West Atlanta, Fontaine Lane. Forgot the box, nigga got 30 years. Lord forgive me and my foes. I know revenge is best or cold by those who feel no guilt. God don't care whether you got a spade or not. Ain't no turning in your playing hand. Was dealt, better tighten up your belt, man. Always go with your first instinct, cause I don't make the rules. Ooh, you know how it is in these streets. Victims rarely get a chance to think twice.
As he laid in his final resting place, he had such a peaceful expression on his face. My vision's blurry from crime, but it ain't hard to see that at any given time it could have been me. It's about 90 degrees outside, but yet I feel like I'm froze. The ceremony's come to a close, I toss and rolls. Just can't seem to walk away yet. I done fucked around and got upset. But it ain't nothing we can do. It's bigger than me and you. One day our time coming too. Ain't no use in being sad. Leaving him was probably the best gift he ever had. We should be glad. Maybe his life was something that he had to give to show me that I need to be responsible by how I live. I won't complain about my pain, but I just ain't gonna let my nigga die in vain. So Bean, I'm gonna make it for you. The cycle that these young black men keep going through, I'm gonna break it for you. And start taking care of me and me, consist of all my friends and my family. From now on, until I'm gone.
Born into these crooked ways, I never even asked to come. So now I'm living in the days. I struggle and fight to stay alive, hoping that one day I earn a chance to die. Paul bearer to this one, Paul bearer to that one. Can't seem to get the grip, cause my palms sweat.
All right, y'all, this is Anti-War Radio. Whoa, shit. Sorry about that. Radio Chaos 95.9 in Austin, Texas. And, yeah, I'm Scott. So did you guys see the thing about Eric Edelman and Hillary Clinton? Neither of these is the good guy in this situation, but, you know, for, propaganda purposes, Hillary sometimes, depending on which audience she's in front of, likes to pretend that, she would, you know, in some sense want to, hurry up and end the war. in Iraq, which is pure lies, and she makes that clear when she's talking in front of people who actually have power. That's just really for her base. But she asked the Defense Department, a U.S. senator, asked the Defense Department, do you guys have a plan for withdrawal from Iraq? And Eric Edelman denounced her and said that she was giving aid and comfort to the enemy. I don't think those were his exact words. But he said that, you know, you're strengthening the enemy by saying that. And Clinton rightly responded something to the order of, hey, fuck you, I'm a United States senator. How dare you? And, you know, that to me is just a little taste of the neoconservatives in action. For those of you who are not familiar with this particular brand of bloodthirsty warmonger, Eric Edelman is just the quintessential being to prove just the arrogance. Justin Raimondo calls them the cult of power, and that's exactly right. Some low-level third or fourth level National Security Council guy telling a United States senator, how dare you ask about whether the Defense Department has a plan for withdrawal? Well, what the hell is a neocon? A neocon is someone who used to be a commie and then became a Republican because the Republicans are more willing to use violent force, so the myth goes. When in the 1960s, liberals became the anti-war movement, these guys said nuts to that. How are we ever going to get anybody killed in a party full of hippies? We need to join the Republican Party. And that's what they are. They're left-wing radicals. In fact, here I got the clip of Michael Ledeen saying, why would anybody ever call us conservatives? I have no idea.
Matter of fact, most of those who came over to be called neoconservatives into the Republican Party came from the radical left, from the Democratic side.
The word was invented by Irving Kristol. Right, who said a neoconservative is a liberal who's been mugged by reality. There are many of us, Richard Perle being the greatest example, and I think basically we still think of ourselves as Scoop Jackson Democrats.
See, there you go. There's Ledeen telling you, we didn't even change. We just changed parties. We're still left-wing radicals who want to use American military force to remake the world our way. Richard Perle and Michael Ledeen being the two worst, most obvious and worst examples of the neoconservative movement that we're talking about. And so, there you go. This is the kind of arrogance. I guess it comes from being a former Trotskyite. Boy, you have to know you're right about everything to be a Trotskyite, don't you? It takes a certain special kind of imperial hubris to tell a United States senator, how dare you even pretend to have oversight over this executive branch at war, lady. Go piss off. You're helping the enemy. The fact that David Woomser, Abram Shulsky, Eric Edelman, Elliot Abrams, John Hanna, that any of these neocons are still in power in this government is just absolutely infuriating. I can't believe it. And I can't believe that Bush got reelected in the first place. I mean, I knew he would, and I said he would for a year leading up to it. But, you know what I really should have done in 2004, instead of wasting my time trying to be a foreign policy advisor to Michael Badnart, what I should have done was I should have campaigned around the country for re-elect Dick Cheney and the ex-communist brigade. Re-elect Dick Cheney and Eric Edelman and Elliot Abrams and Stephen Hadley and John Hanna and David Addington. Re-elect the Cheney cabal. Not that things would have been much better under Kerry, but it wouldn't have been Eric Edelman, and that would be something. All right, next. Pat Tillman murdered on purpose, huh? The Associated Press has a Freedom of Information Act request results. They went back, and it turns out this guy had three M16 bullet holes right in his forehead. that, according to the coroner, must have been fired from within 10 yards. It says that the whole story about stop shooting, I'm Pat effing Tillman over here, was a lie. That didn't happen. In fact, they said his last words were, quit sniveling, you sniveling little, to the guy next to him who was saying, oh my God, we're being shot at. There's also emails, apparently, that show generals congratulating each other on preventing this thing from becoming a criminal investigation. Looks like the death of Pat Tillman. Now, of course, they lied, right? It was right after the Abu Ghraib story broke. And they said, oh, forget Abu Ghraib. A football hero got killed by the evil terrorist Al-Qaeda. Remember that? I remember right-wing radio going, oh, thank God we don't have to talk about Abu Ghraib anymore. Oh, Pat Tillman, he's like our Jesus Christ. He died for our sins, boy. Oh, my God. No, well, it turns out he was murdered. And we don't know who, and it's probably, you know, most likely that we never will know who, because whoever it was that murdered him was a government employee. And government employees are allowed to murder whoever they want. We all know that. Here we are, 3 years later. And this guy who the government doesn't hesitate for 1 minute to use for their propaganda purposes when they want to make you feel bad for not sending your boy to go join the army. When it comes to the truth about what happened to him, oh, well, his mother and father and brother and friends and relatives and cousins and so forth, be damned. They don't have the right to know what happened to their loved one. Screw them. He makes a good propaganda poster. And that's good enough. What? Three bullet holes right in the forehead, right next to each other? Well, that doesn't sound like he accidentally got shot from far away when he was on top of a cliff and they were under enemy fire. Oh, that was another one. No enemy fire. There was no enemy fire of any kind, apparently, according to the new documents unearthed by the Associated Press. There was no enemy fire in the entire situation. Does anybody think that anyone will ever really know the truth about what happened to that guy? I mean, hell, I wouldn't put it past him at this point that somebody said, oh my God, this Abu Ghraib thing is terrible. Kill that Pat Tillman guy. For all I know, that's the motive. Now, maybe, you know, it wasn't. Maybe it was personal. I don't know. Sure was convenient timing, his death, though. Oh, John Conyers is a despicable coward. John Conyers is the lowest form of life in the American Congress. Lower even than Harry Reid. John Conyers is a coward. John Conyers hates liberty and he hates truth. And he refuses to live up to his responsibility as chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. And I can't wait to see Cindy Sheehan kick Nancy Pelosi's ass. The 23rd has come and gone, Lady Speaker. I can't wait to watch Cindy Sheehan thrash you come November 2008 when she challenges you for your... Well, hell, it'll probably be next spring when she kicks your ass in the primary, right? You better raise that money, Nancy. You better raise that money. So here's John Conyers, who, from the very first time I ever laid eyes on this guy, wanted to bash his skull with a rock. That's not a threat. It's just saying, you know, I think it would be fun. Not that I would ever do it, because, of course, I couldn't get away with it, and I don't want to go to jail. I'm just saying, I think it would be funny if somebody else bashed John Conyers' skull with a rock. That's all. Have you ever seen Waco, The Rules of Engagement? Well, then, see, you know how I feel. John Conyers, the most despicable form of life in the U.S. Congress. It's his job to issue articles of impeachment against a president and or vice president and or an attorney general of the United States who commit high crimes and misdemeanors. And Ray McGovern and Cindy Sheehan and others went to John Conyers' office the other day and said, hey, man, you need a reason. They had a little chant. I forgot how it went. I'm not much for chanting. But they had a little chant. Oh, you need a reason? How about lying us into war torturing people, tapping Americans' telephones with the United States military? How about that for starters? How about pardoning Scooter Libby, who's a witness in a case involving the president's own criminality? How about that? That's specifically one of the reasons for impeachment listed by the founders in the Federalist Papers and the rest of their writings. That's how you know it's time to impeach and remove a president from power, is when he's committing crimes and the people helping him do it are getting pardoned to keep their mouths shut. That's what impeachment is for. And you know, John Conyers says that he doesn't have the votes. I'm sorry, Mr. McGovern. I'm sorry, Ms. Sheehan. I just don't have the votes. Oh, really? Well, 45% of the American people, as it stands right now, with the media refusing to discuss this issue at all on TV, at all. 45% of the American people are ready to see George Bush impeached right now. And of course, you know, to the average American, impeached means removed too. A majority of the American people, again, with this subject not in the media at all, a majority of the American people want Dick Cheney removed from power. And John Conyers says he doesn't have the votes. Well, back when Bill Clinton was being impeached for the silly sex scandal instead of all his corruption and accepting all that money from the Chinese government by way of the Riotti family and so forth, in exchange for licensing missile technology transfers to them, was 35% of the American people supported that, and they got the votes in the House of Representatives. What John Conyers is saying is, to paraphrase, I, John Conyers, am a coward. And I'm scared that if I go and begin to issue articles of impeachment against the president, that bad people will call me mean names. And what if I try to do articles of impeachment and then I can't get the votes on the House floor? Wouldn't that be bad? That's cowardice, see? Because all John Conyers has to do is issue the articles of impeachment. I could write them up in an afternoon. Don't tell me that, you know, you're going to really have trouble coming up with impeachable offenses committed by this administration. Bruce Fein, the guy who wrote the articles of impeachment against Bill Clinton, says that the case for impeaching Bush and Cheney is much greater. Okay? The guy who wrote the articles of impeachment against Bill Clinton says the case against Bush and Cheney is much worse. Why don't you call up Bruce Fein and ask him to help you out, Mr. Conyers, you coward? And then why don't you call out the Democrats who won't vote with you? You only need 51% in the House of Representatives to pass the articles of impeachment up to the Senate. Why don't you do a little politicking, Mr. Conyers? And why don't you twist some arms and put some pressure? Why not call out the Democrats who won't join you in public? The American people want these men removed from power. And this, of course, would be great for the Democrats. It would save Nancy Pelosi the humiliation of being soundly defeated by Cindy Sheehan in the primaries next spring. She'd be president of the United States. And all she has to do is vow to not run and not make Hillary or Obama her vice president, since that would be cheating. And she can be the placeholder in the presidency until January 2009. What's so hard about that? Well, you have to have, you know, expansive vision to come up with that. But of course, the problem here, again, is that John Conyers is a coward. John Conyers is a piece of garbage. And you know, if the Bush impeachment removal thing doesn't get you, go watch Waco, The Rules of Engagement. And then get back to me about John Conyers. And dang it, I'm not going to have time to read you this article by William Arkin, although I will point you to it. Damn. See, too much time ranting against stupid Conyers. Early warning, William Arkin's blog at the Washington Post, opening the nuclear front, where he says, hey, we ought to rethink our nuclear policy and maybe start downsizing our stockpile. Good start. Anyway, that's right there in the viewpoint section, opening the nuclear front on the front page of antiwar.com. And I guess I was going to mention Gonzalez and his perjury, but you all already saw that, right? Gonzalez says, no, we went to John Ashcroft's bedside while he was, you know, under sedation, coming back from surgery. But no, it didn't have anything with getting him to sign off on a National Security Agency military phone tapping of the American people program. No, it had nothing to do with that. Well, the director of the FBI, Robert Mueller, says otherwise. That's right, the director of the FBI directly contradicting the sworn statement of the Attorney General of the United States. But no, Conyers doesn't even have the courage to impeach Alberto Gonzalez. What a coward. And, you know, he's the guy who claims to, you know, he's one of these guys like Jesse Jackson who claims to be the inheritor of the legacy of Martin Luther King. You know, it's funny. I don't remember about Martin Luther King that it was some big part of his character that he was a sniveling coward. But then, you know, maybe Conyers isn't really his heir after all.
Your beef is mine. So long as the sun shines to light up the sky, we in this together, son. Your beef is mine. As time goes by, an eye for an eye, we in this together, son. Your beef is mine. So long as the sun shines to light up the sky, we in this together, son. Your beef is mine. Let me start from the beginning at the top of the list. Know what I mean? Half situation like this. Another war story from a thirsty young hustler. Won't trust her, I'd rather bust her and leave you caught for the cops to discover. Well, I'll be vipping in the Range Rover. All too well like Liberace. Watch me while Jake's trying to knock me and lock me. But I'll be on the low sipping Osti Spumante. Niggas try to creep on the side of my teeth. Stuck the heat through the window, rock their ass to sleep. Over a 3-pack. It was a small thing, really, yeah, but keep letting them small things slide and be a failure. If I'm out of town, one of my crew will take care of you. The world is ours, and your team's inferior. You wanna bust caps, I get all up in your area. Kidnapping children make the situation scarier. Life is a gamble, we scramble for money. I might crack a smile, but ain't a damn thing funny. I'm caught up in the dirt with your hands get muddy. Plus the outcome turns out to be lovely. Got cheese in my pocket, hit off my main squeeze. Push back the sunroof, let the cold air breeze through the butter, soft leather upholstery. But mostly, keep the gag closely, cause niggas wanna toast.
And yo, I gotta get mines, no matter what the consequences. Count on my blessings, out of my weapons. Cop out the gat and let my nine serve purpose. Sling do my thing, organize thing service. Trying to make a meal of stress, you know the deal. So we sling thrills, get your cap hill. Cause everything is real, cause I wanna chill. Laid up in a jacuzzi, sip a bubbly with my fingers on the Uzi. Try to infiltrate my fork, get caught dead up in New York. My brain is back with criminal thoughts. Get your life lost, never found again, my friend. Mission completed, watch you drop in less than 10. On my road to the riches, hitting snitches off of mad stitches. The last rest, the place will be your ditch, kid. No one can stop me, try your style sloppy. You wanna be me, you're just an imitation copy. My theme is all about making the green, living up in luxury, pushing fat whips and living comfortably.
Time goes by, an eye for an eye. We in this together, son, your beef is mine. So long as the sunshine can light up the sky. We in this together, son, your beef is
a
mine.
A drug dealer's dream, stash cream, keys on a triple beam. 500 Estelle Green, 95 nickel gleam. Condominium, thug dressed like a gentleman. Tailor-made ostrich, Chanel for my women friend. Murdering, numbers on your head while I'm burglaring. Shank is serving them, what's up to all my niggas swerving in New York metropolis. The bridge brings apocalypse, shoot at the clouds, feels like the holy beast is watching us. Madman, my sanity is going like an hourglass. Gun inside my bad hand, I slice trying to bag grams. I got hoes that used to milk you, niggas who could have killed you. It's down with my ill crew of psychos. Nas Escobar moving on your weak production, pumping corruption in the third world, we just bustin'.
Hold up bustin'. And analyze the wildcats, sling cracks, they swinging axe. The new routines, be my eyes blacks, playing corners, glancing all up in your cornea. Cornea, seen cats snatch money's upon ya. But late night, candlelight, fiend with a crack right. It's only right, feeling higher than an airplane, right? Word, yo, I wanna get this money, then blow. Take my time, blast a nine if you're front, you go. Sip beers, the German ones, hand my guns, the sons. Shallon and Queensbridge, we robbing niggas for fun. But still, write my will, I turn my seeds then bill. Mahalia, sing a tale, but the real, we still kill.
As time goes by, and eye for an eye, we in this together, son, your beef is mine. So long as the sun shines, the light up the skies. We in this together, son, your beef is mine. As time goes by, an eye for an eye, we in this together, son, your beef is mine. So long as the sun shines, can light up the skies. We in this together, son, your beef is mine. It's mine.
Lay back, word out, just bless them with the bulletproof. More beef. Nice, chef creation for your nation, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Okay, hey, it's Chaos Radio, and kind of chaotic here today. Having trouble getting a hold of my guest. Phone's going straight to voicemail. Man, I hate that, but there you go. If I don't get a hold of him, I guess I could ruin the interview for you by playing some of the good sound bites and so forth and getting into the subject matter anyway. But I'll try to put that off, see if I can't get a hold of Max Blumenthal for you guys. But now, let me go ahead and, discuss this, William Arkin article that I didn't have time to get to. This is the early warning blog at the Washington Post. Opening the nuclear front, the Bush administration opened a nuclear front in its various wars this week, firing a paper at Congress arguing that nuclear weapons are at a critical juncture and continue to be essential for U.S. national security. The statement, all of three pages, is essentially a justification for the U.S. nuclear arsenal and a new nuclear warhead. There is, however, a glimmer of hope in a report that is mostly boilerplate. The glimmer is in the paper's tone, which is almost pleading. Amid the arguments that nuclear weapons have been an essential element of deterrence since President Truman, and that the principal U.S. national security goal is deterring aggression against ourselves, our allies, and friends, there is the sense that the U.S. is trying too hard to justify a policy that perhaps it realizes is becoming obsolete. With Congress increasingly questioning the Bush administration's nuclear weapons strategy and its pursuit of new nuclear warheads and nuclear capabilities, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates joined with Secretary of Energy Samuel Bodman and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in issuing the report Friday titled National Security and Nuclear Weapons: Maintaining Deterrence in the 21st Century. The paper argues that despite the demise of the Soviet Union, the future security environment is very uncertain and some trends are not favorable. Rogue states, code for Iran and North Korea, either have or seek weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons. Wow, that's a pretty bold assertion, considering that North Korea shut down all of their reactors and turned the whole place over to the IAEA in exchange for a massive American welfare check, much larger than what they were getting under the deal Clinton got them that Bush broke unilaterally. And especially considering that the IAEA is standing right now at the Natanz facility going, I don't see anybody making any nuclear bombs here in Iran. But anyway, we got to start with a false assertion in order to come to a false conclusion, folks. That's how we do it here in the U.S. government. More states, it says, could develop nuclear weapons and establish nuclear powers. Russia, China, Pakistan, India, Israel, all unnamed, could pursue aggressive nuclear force modernization programs. All of this requires the United States to continue to offer assurances of security for our allies, and U.S. nuclear weapons continue to serve, quote, as the ultimate guarantor of their security. A nuclear arsenal demonstrates, quote, to allies and adversaries alike that the United States has the necessary means and the political will to respond decisively against aggression and the use of weapons of mass destruction. And again, no irony there whatsoever. In this regard, Iran and North Korea are explicitly mentioned. But it's not as if the United States is headed for nuclear disarmament. Even with a Democratic Congress or a Democratic president, that's not likely. probably less likely under the Democrats. Are you kidding? Been waging war since Andrew Jackson. Since Thomas Jefferson. The report argues that Congress needs to continue to support a responsive nuclear infrastructure. That means robust research and a commitment to maintaining technical expertise in nuclear weapons, and even the ability to renew underground testing if necessary. Most important, it means the reliable replacement warhead, a new weapon that the administration and the nuclear priesthood hopes to build in large numbers. None of this is surprising, but that doesn't mean it's the right direction. William Arkin, from the Early Warning blog at the Washington Post, see no value in using nuclear weapons in our disputes with North Korea and Iran. In fact, brandishing them merely serves to encourage our adversaries to develop their own. Furthermore, when it comes to Russia and China, our goal must be to seek reductions and constraints. And as for the value of our nuclear weapons vis-a-vis India, Pakistan, or Israel, the history is clear. Our nuclear weapons have bought us nothing but their justifications. Perhaps it is time to adopt the post-9/11 stance when it comes to nuclear weapons, including our own. We cannot just wait for stuff to happen to us. We have to take action. Ultimately, that means a commitment to deeper reductions and a further marginalizing of the role nuclear weapons play in U.S. foreign policy. Well said, of course, William Arkin, never radical enough for me, but at least he's making the point in a place where, you know, military-minded folks are liable to see it. What the hell does America need with 10,000 nuclear bombs? Or is it 30? I forget. What do we need with all these nukes? Nothing. That's what. A nuclear weapon cannot be used discriminately. I guess maybe if you're talking about, you know, the European EU Navy is coming across the Atlantic to invade the coast of South Carolina or something, you know, I guess dropping an atom bomb on their fleet in the middle of the ocean, tough, you know, bad news for the whales and so forth, but basically that's the only way you could use a nuclear bomb on all combatants and not innocents. It is an indiscriminate weapon. And frankly, America doesn't need nuclear weapons. We have two friendly neighbors to the north and south. We have two oceans to either side of us. We have two mountain ranges. And we have 500 million, 500 million privately owned firearms for 300 million people. And that's counting the old ladies and the little babies. No one can conquer America, ever. No navy could land on our coast unless maybe they nuke the hell out of it. But even then, there's no aggressor against the United States that has nuclear weapons. And there's no purpose in attacking America with nuclear weapons, which is the only way you could possibly attack America. If we were unarmed, if we had no nukes, and they did, that's still no good way to attack the United States. That's just a way for them to completely screw themselves. Who wants to conquer an America covered in radiation? An America that's been nuked off the face of the earth. There's no good in conquering a land like that. And frankly, if there was another nation, say Russia, for example, who dropped some nuclear bombs on America, our military could still at least blast the government of Russia to hell without nuclear bombs. We could send our jets right over Moscow and reduce the Kremlin to rubble. Put a laser sight on old Vladimir Putin and drop a Moab bomb on him. Some TNT or some RDX or whatever high-type explosives. We don't need nuclear weapons to protect from other states that have them. And frankly, the only reason anybody would ever get in a nuclear war with the United States is if our government started it. Does anybody doubt that? We don't need nuclear weapons. Any other country attacks us, we can still take them on without nukes. And win. And ultimately, even if we had no army at all, no foreign military force could ever conquer and occupy this land. Ever. You know, you think the insurgents in Mosul are are successful in fighting off the Americans. Let's wait till some occupying army tries to come here. You know, as the American people divide up into, you know, 600,000 little groups of Wolverine militias, Minutemen, strike forces, and whatever. Of course, they'll call us all tied to Al-Qaeda. But nobody could conquer this country. We don't need nuclear weapons. You can't use a nuclear weapon without killing women and children. You can't even use one without killing indiscriminately. And there's no moral justification to have them whatsoever. And I'll tell you this too. The rest of the people around the world, they know that there's only one country that's ever used nuclear weapons in war. And that's us. And in fact, unlike you, the rest of the people of the world pretty much know, at least in large part, they know that the Japanese had been attempting to surrender to the United States of America for more than 6 months before Truman nuked them. They only had one condition: please let us keep our emperor. But Truman said, nope, unconditional surrender only. And of course, after nuking them, and after accepting the surrender, they let him keep the emperor anyway. I forget if that was actually a condition in the peace, or whether that was just a wink nudge. But they let him keep the emperor anyway. In fact, that's another thing that's covered in that article that I was reading to you last hour from LouRockwell.com, or talking with you about Roosevelt and the United Nations and World War II and all that. Sorry, I forgot the name of the article. But he also talks about how the anti-Hitler movement within the German government, the people who were attempting to assassinate Hitler and marginalize Hitler and coup d'etat Hitler and kill Hitler, that when Roosevelt announced the unconditional surrender only policy, which Stalin and Churchill were not asking for, the people who were trying to kill Hitler gave up and said, well, shit, I guess we might as well fight. Since even if we kill Hitler, we still won't be able to make peace. We're going to have to fight till the very last man anyway. And so that's what destroyed the efforts of the permanent state in Germany from overthrowing their Nazi dictator. And of course, the only condition they were already offering to surrender to America and Britain. They just didn't want to surrender to the Russians. And then Roosevelt came in and said, nope, only unconditional surrender. And kept the war going longer. And forced them to surrender to the Russians, who of course got to conquer and enslave all of Eastern Europe as a result. Boy, that Franklin Roosevelt is the greatest president ever. I don't know anything about him, but all the historian polls say that he was the best president America ever had. And turned the Constitution inside out, got 3,500 kids killed deliberately in order to lie the American people into a war that they opposed by 88%, put off saving anyone from the Holocaust till the very last moment in the war to give Eastern Europe to Stalin. Boy, he's great, that Franklin Roosevelt. He's a hero, or else why would the American people have elected him four times? Because we all know that if somebody is elected, that that's, you know, by definition, the right thing. And that anything that they do after that is wonderful. Because otherwise, you know, what are we supposed to do? Stop believing that in a democracy that when some plurality gives an office to a man that, you know, he becomes a god king? We're supposed to give up on that? No way. I want my God King so I can put all my liberty and all my responsibility in his hands instead of having to take care of myself. That's why people this day still love George Bush. They just can't admit to themselves that not just that they've been wrong this time, but just how wrong they've been all this time. Like, screw it. I'd rather live in a fantasy land too than admit that I was duped by a retard. You know, that an absolute illiterate half-wit who knows nothing about nothing fooled me. I don't want to admit that. Forget that. You just hate Bush. That's your problem. You just hate Bush. Of course I hate Bush. I start out hating him. Well, actually, that's not really true. I did. But I haven't found anything to make me feel any other emotion toward him except hate. And I've been paying close attention. But yeah, you know, full disclosure, I did hate him all along. First vote I ever cast here in Texas was against George Bush for governor. I could see it then. It was 1994. Oh man, they're moving to make this guy. He's going to be an incumbent governor in 2000. Oh shit. They're going to try to run this guy for president. And, you know, if there's a sin I got to repent for, it's voting for Ann Richards. But at least it was against George W. Bush. I didn't know about the Libertarian Party then. I would have voted Libertarian. See, I already talked about what a coward, what a sniveling little bitch John Conyers is, right? Okay, I don't want to go over that too much more. Gonzalez, perjury. I'll tell you what, I'm going to play another tune for you guys and see if I can't get old Max Blumenthal on the radio here for you. On the subject of, well, this kook, John Hagee. This clip here is from World War IV, the movie by Don Craven Jr.
There's an army of 200 million marching down the River Euphrates, coming toward the Persian Gulf. There's going to be the meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion that is unplanned for on the charts of all of the dictators of the earth. It's not an invasion from the north or the south or the east or the west. It's an invasion from heaven. And he will establish his kingdom, and of his kingdom there shall be no end. I am telling you, that makes this message one of the most thrilling prophetic messages you've ever heard in your life. You could get raptured out of this building before I get through finished preaching. We are that close. John the Revelator says in Revelation the 19th, and I, John, saw the heavens open, and he that sat upon a white horse was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness doth he judge and make war. And out of his mouth shall go a two-edged sword, with which he shall smite the nations of the earth.
Come, you masters of war, ye that build the big guns, ye that build the death planes, ye that build all the bombs, ye that hide behind walls, ye that hide behind discs, I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy, you play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes, and you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won, you want me to believe. But I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire, and then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled prepare to bring children into the world. For threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed, you ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know? But to talk out of turn, you must say that I'm young. You must say I'm unlearned. But there's one thing I know, I'm younger than you. Even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find, when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I follow your casket by the pale afternoon. I watch while you're lowered down to your deathbed, and I stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead.
All right, folks. I can't get a hold of my guest.
So we're here with Representative Tom DeLay, the one and only former representative.
Winamp sucks so bad. Jesus Christ, dude. If you work for Winamp, I just insulted you and your stupid company and your crappy products. It was free. I can't really complain. I can't get a hold of Max Blumenthal, but I want to play you some audio from this video that he posted up on the Huffington Post blog. You can find it also on the antiwar.com blog and also on thestressblog.com. But his original post there at Huffington Post. And what happened was Max Blumenthal went on July 16th to a big meeting of Christians United for Israel, which is a lobbying group created by Minister John Hagee, the nutball that you heard before the last song, who, well, in simplest terms, basically the deal is this. A certain brand of born-again Christian, and I forget the whole name for it. It's really long and complicated. Something about the dispensationalist, this and that, and something else. It isn't all Christians by any means, or all Protestants even, by any means. But there's a certain group of American, I guess, Baptists? Whatever, who think that the apocalypse is taking too damn long. It's 2007. This thing was all supposed to go down on Y2K, don't you know? So what the hell? They want Armageddon now, and they are trying to force Jesus' hand. You will hear in one of these clips a woman say, yeah, the devil is trying to destroy God's plan, and we have to stop him. What the hell kind of blasphemy is that? I mean, I'm not a religious guy, but I know that's blasphemy. Is this lady saying that the devil can defeat God? Doesn't that throw off the entire premise of monotheism? That God created the devil and could kick his ass any day of the week if he so chose? That good always wins in the end because good and God are more powerful than evil and the devil? Isn't that just basic basics? No, we uneducated, you know, Walmart religion Texans have to protect God from the devil attempting to ruin his plan, according to these dingbats. And the only reason I care, because I honestly don't care. People can believe whatever they want. I try not to attack people for their religious beliefs, even though I don't share them, because what the hell? You know, a lot of people need faith to get through the day. Far be it from me to tell them otherwise. But these people want a nuclear war with Iran. See? And so that's a problem. In fact, they want a nuclear war with Russia and Iran. That's the way the story goes, according to John Hagee, is that Iran and Russia get in a nuclear war against Israel, and then Jesus comes in the middle of this and calls a halt. All the true believers get raptured up to heaven, and anybody who doesn't accept Jesus that day burns in a lake of fire forever, including the Jews that they claim to love so much. And you might ask yourself why the Israel lobby would get in bed with a bunch of kooks who ultimately want them all dead. And that's a pretty good question. Irving Kristol answered it back in 1980, saying, hey, it's their theology, it's our Israel. So if it's useful for them to prop up the thankfully dead Jerry Falwell or, you know, Pat Robertson or any of these people, that's just fine. And this John Hagee is an absolute nut. And I just want to, since I can't get my interview with Max Blumenthal today, I wanted to at least go ahead and play you some clips of the insanity going on at this Christians United for Israel conference that took place on July 16th. It begins with this interview of Tom DeLay, the Hammer.
So we're here with Representative Tom DeLay. The one
former.
And only former representative, the Hammer. Can I call you the Hammer?
Sure.
So what brings you to Christians United for Israel?
Well, I was in on the ground floor. I've worked with John and Diana Hagee for many, many years on many different projects.
And how much of an inspiration is the Second Coming in your support for Israel?
Obviously, it's what I live for.
Really?
And I hope it comes tomorrow.
Really? Really?
Absolutely.
Wow.
And obviously, we have to be connected to Israel in order to enjoy the second coming of Christ.
The denials by Pastor Hagee and his...
So there you go. You heard Tom DeLay explaining that he's in a big hurry to be raptured up to heaven. And America must support Israel in order for Tom DeLay to get his rapture. Now, this is Max Blumenthal talking to some of the goofballs standing around at this convention here.
The denials by Pastor Hagee and his minions of an ulterior end times agenda were directly contradicted by members of their own organization.
Basically, I believe that you have to embrace Israel as part of the second coming.
But when the battle of Armageddon is over and they come out of hiding and they see him and he tells them who he is, they say, who is this?
The Jews will accept Christ.
The Jews accept Christ as a nation then, and they are restored.
The Jews are God's chosen people, but they will, I mean, they have to be witnessed to just like anybody else.
Yeah.
There's only one way to heaven, and that's in John 14:6.
What's going to happen to the non-believer? Well, I think it's pretty clear they're not going to be in heaven. So the other place is not too pleasant.
And you're Jewish as well?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
living
call,
yeah.
And do you believe in the Lord Jesus Christ?
Well, I'm Jewish. So are you going to pray for me afterwards?
Certainly will.
Actually, we've been praying for the whole Jewish race for a long time.
Really?
Yes.
You've been praying for the whole Jewish race?
We're praying that y'all see the Messiah, because we believe that Jesus is the Messiah, and you guys haven't really come to that recognition yet, but we believe that you will.
That's the battle of Armageddon. It's the believers against the non-believers. It's Christians against the anti-Christians.
Are you looking forward to Armageddon?
I definitely am.
So you're looking forward to Armageddon.
Looking forward to Armageddon and looking forward to the cleansing of the earth.
Are you guys looking forward to the rapture?
Amen. Amen. Well, I got a bag packed.
Can I get your car when it happens?
You can have everything I own when it happens.
That'll be the last of your worries.
When we disappear, you better start to worry. Because if you have seen the Left Behind series, it's scary.
Really?
Yes.
The one with Kirk Cameron, right, from Growing Pains?
I don't even remember. But another reason why we...
Oh, what a great line. It's really too bad I don't have this guy on the phone right now. This would be a lot funner. But, yeah, so there you have it, folks. It's going to be us Christians versus the anti-Christians. Haven't you ever seen the movie of Left Behind? Because, of course, we're too goddamn stupid to have even read the Walmart books. Have you ever seen the movie Left Behind? It's going to be just like that. Blumenthal says, Is that the one with Kirk Cameron from Growing Pains? It's going to be just like in that made-for-TV movie. You ever seen that? And again, now here's the thing. I'm not just making fun of these people's religion. I really don't care what religion you believe in. I really don't mind if a certain brand of evangelical born-again believes that there's a whole bunch of magic about to happen. What bothers me is that these people have a policy, and they support a policy, and they are a major force that cannot be denied inside the Republican Party. And they double and triple and quadruple the strength of the Israel lobby in this country, which already has far too great a hold over American Middle East policy. And now this Christians United for Israel propaganda machine, which is basically what it was, has convinced people that the Muslims, apparently because they look different, they're brown, and they talk different, language I can't even understand from here, they are the forces of Satan. And it's okay for our government to kill them, obviously, the women, the children, anyone, because they are the devil.
But another reason why we support Israel, we have a common enemy.
Who's
the
that?
The Quran is a false, it's absolutely not the word of God. I was a member of the mainline church, and I'm no different than a Muslim.
So we're fighting what is behind the Muslim people, which is Satan. Because Satan is the one who's actually trying to destroy the Jewish race. Because that way he would destroy God's plan.
And what will happen is Israel and the Western world, in order to save our type of civilization, have got to fight the Muslim. And if we don't take out Iran one way or another, if we move out of Iraq, the Muslims are going to take over and they're going to follow us here.
So you see, this is all just talking points, right? He does this whole religious thing, and then it all ends with, well, you know, they're going to follow us home if we leave Iraq, which is the George Bush talking point. Maybe he heard that at church, too. Ultimately, this is all about Iran. We have to nuke Iran. We have to kill the human beings in Iran because they are Satan. They are the devil. If we don't nuke them, they, the Muslim, I love the communist collectivist language of these right-wing nationalists. The Muslim, meaning a billion separate and distinct individuals, every one of whom was born free and with a natural right to ownership of their own life. Thank you very much. The Muslim is a front for Satan. And if we, meaning the secular, supposedly American government, don't stop them, they will destroy God's plan. God needs the new world to prevent Satan from defeating him. Now, what a bunch of crap is that? Is there a minister anywhere in Texas who's not, you know, just one of these money-making John Hagee liars? Is there an actual believing, you know, Christian minister anywhere in Texas who will tell you that that's right? Someone who's not part of this John Hagee propaganda machine. Are there actual Christian ministers who will tell you that the devil can defeat God at his own game unless America intervenes on God's behalf? How do these people who are raised Christian accept these premises? They have to know that that ain't right. They have to know the very basic premise of the Jewish, Christian, Muslim, one God is that he is good. And that he created evil as a small and pathetic subset of the rest of his plan. God is going to lose to the devil if America doesn't get into a nuclear war against Iran. That's never attacked us, never attacked Israel, never done a thing to anyone. Haven't fought a war since the revolution in 79. Not a single war. Well, that ain't right. They defended themselves from Iraqi aggression backed by the United States. But other than that. And how will you know? How will you know the Antichrist when he's prepared to take over the world? because, you know, he will be a man of peace. He will be a deceiver. How will we recognize the Antichrist for who he is?
The one who forces Israel into a peace treaty with the Arabs is the one who is, you have to watch out for.
Is the beast.
Right.
Therefore, it is time for America to embrace the words of Senator Joseph Lieberman and consider a military preemptive strike against Iran to prevent a nuclear holocaust in Israel and a nuclear attack on Iran.
My friends, there was actually a really great great piece in the American Prospect about this guy Hagee. And what you have to understand about this guy is, first of all, he's a millionaire, as Max Blumenthal explains in his piece. Has a gigantic ranch and a giant Greek mansion, and, you know, drives around in Rolls Royces and so forth like he's Jim Baker. But the thing is, he's a goddamned liar, and he knows it, see? When he's talking to these illiterate goofballs who have to watch the Kirk Cameron TV movie of the Rapture books that they can't buy at Walmart because they're just too hard to get through, when he talks to them, he says, oh, Jesus this and Jesus that, and that's why we have to bomb Iran. They've got nuclear weapons, don't you know, and they're going to wipe Israel off the map. But when he's talking to people who actually have educations, he says, well, there are some indications that Iran has a secret program, which there's not, of course, but still, that they have a secret nuclear program that is designed toward nuclear weapons, and it's a major concern, and we really ought to think about having a preemptive war against them trying to make these nuclear bombs. And he goes right back out to his illiterate audience and goes, oh, fire, brimstone, Jesus, whoa, bomb Iran. And he's a damn liar. He knows he's a damn liar. He changes his argument depending on his audience. Unless a Jewish reporter is actually following him around and keeping track of what he says. I don't know why it's always got to be that way, that all the best reporters are Jews, I guess. So here's Max Blumenthal actually gets a chance to confront John Hagee about some of his statements here from the Christians United for Israel conference on July 16th. Listen to Max Blumenthal put Hagee on the spot as Hagee blames the Jews for all the pogroms and persecutions against them in the last couple thousand years.
During the brief session in which Pastor Hagee made himself available to the media, I asked him about passages in his book, Jerusalem Countdown, in which he seemed to blame Jews for their own persecution.
On page 92 of Jerusalem Countdown, you write, "It was the disobedience and rebellion of the Jews, God's chosen people, to their covenantal responsibility to serve the one and only true God, Jehovah, that gave rise to the opposition and persecution that they experienced beginning in Canaan and continuing to this very day. Can you explain your support for Israel and the Jewish people in the context of that quote?"
Yes, that's out of the book of Deuteronomy. Have you ever read it?
Yes, I have. I read the Bible.
Well, it's just as true as when Moses read it as it is right now.
And I just wanted to clarify, if by quoting Deuteronomy or by using this quote, you are holding you are blaming the persecution of the Jewish people on the Jewish people for their rejection of Christ.
I'm not blaming. That is an absolute stretch. I never wrote that in the book.
So
I'm quoting a historical fact.
Can I ask one question?
Just one question. You went over your limit there, Max. So this is what John Hagee tells his flock. Oh, the reason the Holocaust happened to the Jews, all those pogroms in Russia, 6 million dead from the Nazis in Germany. Oh, well, they were asking for it, see. They broke their covenant with God. They rejected Jesus Christ, and that's why they all got what was coming to them. That's what John Hagee, this friend of Israel, tells his flock. And, you know, I really got to wonder about cost-benefit analysis going on there in the Israel lobby, where they think that this is a good idea to align with these nuts. And furthermore, you know, I would like them to know that I really resent the idea that a bunch of, outside money is being used to prop up these crazies who want to destroy my life and my liberty here in Texas, too. You know, we have basically a foreign power propping up a, what should be an extremely marginal group in the United States who are absolutely delusional, who are trying to get us into a nuclear war to make their religion come true. And these, of course, are the same people who are the worst nationalists and the worst domestic warmongers as well. These are the red state fascists, as Lou Rockwell calls them. And, boy, the fact that there's not an anti-Christians United for Israel group that comes together to denounce these crazies and their ties with the right-wing Likud party warmongers in Israel, it's bad news. Everywhere you look, the war party is organized, well-financed, and on the march. And look at us. What's the anti-war movement? Basically amounts to nothing. There is no organized opposition to these people at this point. It sure doesn't seem like to me. And I don't know what else to do about it except sit here and say the same shit again and again. But, you know, that's how I am. No class. Thanks, everybody, for listening. This is Anti-War Radio, Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. See you Monday.